morning. I was thinking, Ms. Baker Galloway, that it is a good day for fishing. And to be a fish, yes. That was the only observation I had to make. Nothing arising from us overnight, anything arising from anybody else. Okay, very good. So, you remain on your oath, and Mr. Moore's got some more questions for you.
Sure. Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for sending through your updated appendix. That will hopefully make this exercise a little easier, at least for me.
Yes, and I just on that, I didn't make any changes to what had already been presented because I didn't think that was the time to be doing that. This is just purely an amalgamation of the joint witness statement plus what was in my supplementary evidence originally.
Very good. Thank you. Right, I do have some questions for you about the drafting that you've put forward. So using this appendix, and for the record, it's updated Appendix A to the supplementary evidence of Claire Perkins, dated 12 April 2021. And I want to start with the objective, or the objectives, on page 14 of the document.
Sure.
And I see that you have recommended the insertion of a second objective. And my first question to you is, was this additional objective sought in the submission of LandPro?
Not explicitly as an objective, no.
Was it sought as a policy or something else?
No, not explicitly, but it comes back to the intention in that submission to have some form of longer pathway available, and there obviously then needs to be supporting objectives and policies and rules around that pathway. But the actual wording or need for the words of saying we need a new objective or a new policy were not mentioned, no.
So this, well, can you describe what you see as the purpose of this new objective that you recommend for insertion?
So this objective is there to support the discretionary activity policy and rule that's sitting behind that, as there needs to be something that then, you know, you follow back up the chain from having that discretionary pathway. So that's really the intended purpose of it there, to enable those environmental gains that we could achieve that otherwise we could end up in a position where they are lost completely in the next 6 years, as has been, you know, put forward in the case of a number of scientists this hearing today.
So when we look at this objective, do you accept that it only covers some of the values that the new NPSFM requires a council to address?
Yes.
And when you look at this objective, can you tell me which of the values it excludes?
It's primarily focused around those threatened species within the freshwater ecosystem, so it's effectively excluded most other things in terms of specific reference.
So it excludes consideration of cultural values?
And as far as the wording itself goes, yes.
Well, the wording's important, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
And it excludes consideration of recreational values?
Yes.
It excludes consideration of amenity values?
Yes.
And when you think about the paradigm shift, well, let's go back a step, do you accept that the transition in the National Policy Statement 2020 confirms the paradigm shift towards a new way of thinking about water management?
Absolutely.
And it approaches the management of water in a water-centric manner?
Yes.
And what do you understand that to mean?
With the health of the water body and everything around it comes first.
And when you say everything about around it, what do you mean?
So everyone that has interest in water in terms of the values it provides, so for ecosystem health, for cultural interest in the waterway, for the mana and the Māori that it represents as well.
So when you think about the breadth of those matters and you read this objective, do you accept that this objective is not furthering the concept of Te Mana or Te Waia capturing the essence of that water-centric approach?
Not in a whole sense, no, but it is going some way towards some of the direction that is going to be needed.
And when you think about the discretionary activity that hangs off this objective, what's the duration that might be sought?
So this is something I have given more thought to since it was put forward in the supplementary evidence. My view now is that probably a 15-year duration is probably more appropriate than 20. I think that's reflected in it still comes within a transition time as far as water and water use is within Otago, there is always a transition period intended within the MPS itself as well, not that it's specifically stated in terms of durations, but there is the acceptance that there will be some transition time. And I think 15 years also then picks up on the reflection of part of that duration of a slightly long term that was picked up in the notified version of PC7.
So when you think about this 15-year time period, you're of the opinion that it's acceptable to exclude consideration of cultural values for the next 15 years?
I think because it's a discretionary pathway, you wouldn't be excluding all of those values. I accept that there isn't any words at the moment in the objectives or policy specifically mentioning cultural values, but in any application, the full range of values can be considered for a discretionary pathway.
Well, that's where it gets a little bit difficult when you're assessing an application against, in this instance, only two objectives. When you sit down and write an application, you'd look carefully at these two objectives as providing information or the outcomes that you'd be seeking?
Yes, but we'd also consider the wider information available and wider documents that we need to consider under Section 104 as well.
So how would you go about assessing cultural values in the context of your discretionary activity application?
It's challenging because we're not cultural experts. The only way that they can be assessed is with that close input from iwi.
And you've listened to, or you've at least read the evidence from the witnesses from Ngaitahu?
Yes, it was a while ago, but yes.
And what did you understand that evidence to be saying?
That at the moment there isn't a clear picture of what those values are, and that they need to participate in the development of the regimes and what needs to go into the land and water plan.
In fact, it went further than that, didn't it, to the evidence, and I'm thinking of the evidence of Mr. Allison, where cultural considerations had been cut out of the process to date.
In my experience, I don't think they have been cut out, but I'm not a cultural expert to know exactly that the feeling that they have in terms of how that's been dealt with. The applications that I have been involved in, particularly the last chance one, there was a lot of consultation to try and pull out from iwi what those values were. I think we made some headway in that, but I don't think we were able to get to a sound conclusion as to exactly what those values are for those water bodies of concern.
And when you think about that last chance decision, do you recall what the decision maker said in relation to the consideration of cultural values?
The restricted discretionary pathway put a significant limiting factor on that.
In fact, the decision maker found that they couldn't be considered. Is that right?
Not as a broad statement of cultural values. No, it was only insofar as part of their concerns could be addressed within part of the matters for discretion.
And so the evidence from Tarunanga was that iwi was placing significant weight on the new land and water regional plan in the process to properly articulate Te Mana o Te Wai in a regional plan as providing it the opportunity to ensure that cultural values are not put to one side. Do you accept that that's a fair reading of that evidence?
I accept that broadly that is, yes.
And so putting in place a flow regime for the next, you say now, 15 years in terms of discretionary activities would push out the consideration of those values through a new flow regime for at least 15 years, wouldn't it?
Yes, for those specific values, but I think it comes back to the significant concerns about do we have 6 years to wait completely and do nothing for 6 years on some of these critical water bodies in terms of threatened species.
So you essentially say it's more important to do something about the potential risks to threatened species than it is to ensure that a flow regime is put in place that properly expresses Te Mana o Te Wai?
Not more important, no, not at all. More that there's something that we could do now to take a step in the right direction, and that after that, if you're talking about a six-year term and then 15-year term, within that next period of 7 to 8 years, you can make those additional either through reviews, or there is another sort of short window of time to bring those consents that managed to go through that pathway, if any, into line with the cultural values as well.
When you think about the review of a consent, and so let's say you have some discretionary activities that have been granted under your recommended rule and policy, would it be your expectation that those consents are reviewed after 6 years and brought into line with the new flow regime and the new land and water plan?
It will depend in part on what flow regime is then put in place in the land and water plan and how close or not that is to what may have been put in place for those discretionary permits. It will then depend on which catchments are considered more of a priority by ORC, the resourcing, timing. There'll be a lot of factors at play. I don't think there's one anyone could say it would happen right on that day.
Sorry to interrupt. Could you just slow the pace of your responses? I really am having trouble following what you're saying and understanding it at the same time. So you just need to...
Sure.
I know it's nerve-wracking and all the rest of it. I don't pretend this is easy. It's the last thing I'd want to do. But you just need to take it down
sure,
a notch.
Sure, I can do that.
Now, where was I?
sorry. You could be anywhere. I'm not actually going so fast. I'm not actually tracking what's actually being said and making sure I understand it.
Consent reviews and the likelihood of them occurring. The reality is consent reviews are challenging for a council.
Yes, I would accept that.
And resource intensive.
Yes.
And if you think about it, it's highly unlikely the council is going to be able to review all consents as soon as the new land and water regional plan, say, is made operative.
No, they won't.
And so, again, the risk of long-term consents is a risk borne by the environment in terms of the time it might take to put in place a NPS-compliant flow regime.
Yes, in effect.
And to move on to the policies now. My first question relates to your deletion of what was the text in policy 10A2.3. So you'll see there that you've replaced that policy with what I describe as your discretionary activity policy.
Yes.
When you think about the controlled activity framework, and you're retaining a controlled activity framework here, what is the consent duration that applies in relation to the controlled activity framework?
6 years.
And where would I find in the policies that you now recommend the policy support for that 6 year time frame?
Yes, I appreciate this last night as I was going through it again in a bit more detail, that there is a gap, that there does need to be a policy reinserted directing that unless otherwise able to follow the pathway provided by 10A2.3, that discretionary pathway, there does need to be a policy alluding to 6 years as being the preferred duration for anyone else in terms of the controlled and restricted discretionary activity pathways.
Does that then also leave a gap in relation to the way you've framed your non-complying activity rule?
Yes, I also recognised that last night, that there would need to be something, and on further reflection last night, my view is actually that the non-complying pathway should actually come back to a 6 years as well. I don't think there should be the ability, as was currently drafted in the rule, for a duration longer than that 15 years that I would indicate.
So how does it work?
Yeah.
I mean, at the moment, what was drafted in there was a controlled rule for 6 years.
Yeah.
An RDA rule for 6 years.
Yeah.
A discretionary rule for what was drafted is up to 20, but I would suggest that be up to 15. And then there's currently a non-complying rule for durations longer than that 20 or 15 years. But on reflection last night, I think that should actually restrict it to 6 years as well, because I don't think there should be a pathway for longer than the 15.
And so in order to achieve that drafting outcome, what changes would you now be recommending be made to the policies?
There would need to be a new policy or, you know, rehash of what was previously included by Mr. Tapalsamaker, indicating that a duration of 6 years was what should be granted outside of those applications or catchments that might fall within the discretionary pathway. So effectively it would have to be a 10A 2.4 inserted. then it would need an exclusion that said except where Rule 10A which one is it? 10A 3.2 didn't apply.
Sorry, 10A 3.2,
which is the discretionary rule. So if the discretionary rule didn't apply, then the duration would be 6 years. It's similar to the way it was drafted, where it originally said except where Rule 10A 3.2.1 applies, so a similar type of drafting.
All right, I have some questions for you now about policy 10A 2.1.
Sure.
And I see there that you have changed the emphasis of the policy in terms of making it perhaps a more positive looking policy by removing the reference to avoid.
That was to pick up the similar way it's phrased in the other policies.
So what? So it's a change for consistency as opposed to a change for another reason.
Effectively, I view it as consistency. It makes easier reading when it's referred to in the same way across all the policies.
Right, tracking down through to your next change, subparagraph B, you've recommended that the increase in irrigation or irrigable land criteria be deleted.
Yes, so this is more in reference to where there has been a time limit restricted on it, but also except, I think as Ms. Bright mentioned yesterday, there are some cases where there are horticulture owners who have purchased trees and have set up areas ready for irrigation that will still be within their historical limits of use because the water is being spread more efficiently, say from pasture to horticulture. There is a reduction in how much you actually need across the whole property, so you could use what was used on one paddock for grass for two paddocks for trees.
So I want to be really careful at understanding what your reason is for removing the restriction on increase in irrigable area. And you've given a couple of answers there, so
sure.
I wonder whether you just might give them to me one at
separately.
A time so we can explore them.
Sure,
and
so
slowly.
Two parts. One being, as Ms. Dicey alluded to yesterday, and my views and knowledge of property owners within Otago, that it's really difficult to go back to a date and know exactly what was being irrigated and when.
Right, so keep going.
Typically, a lot of the farmers I have been working with have a command area or a block, an area on their property which could be irrigated, but at any one time and any one season, some of those blocks might be irrigated and not others. And so
right.
The challenge then is that if you say a certain date, that might not account for some of those paddocks that were being irrigated at that time. And how do we have whether farmers actually have a record back in time, or whether it should just be the area of irrigation at the time of application of consent?
Right, we're now adding multiple reasons. So I want to look at the first explanation you've given first, and I just want to make sure I've understood this. So the first explanation for the deletion is that it might not be possible for a farmer to know what area of land was irrigated at a particular date.
Correct.
So when we look at that reference to particular date, are you referring to the period of time within which the controlled activity rule referred to in terms of the maximum area of irrigated land?
Yes.
And what do you understand Mr. De Pelsmaker to be recommending for that period of time?
That there'd be a limit on the area tied to those dates.
And what are those dates?
1 September 2017 to 18th of March 2020.
So we're dealing with a three-year period?
Correct.
And are you telling me that if I asked each farmer who appears before this court whether they can tell me what area land was irrigated on their property or the maximum area of land irrigated between those dates. They couldn't tell me.
They could broadly tell you a command area. I don't know if they could tell you exact.
And when you say they could broadly tell me the command area, if I gave them a map and asked them to highlight the areas over which they irrigated during that period, do you think they'd be able to do that for me?
I think they could give you an outline on the map of where they have irrigated, whether they're exactly within those dates or not. I don't know.
And then having that map highlighted, it would be relatively straightforward for you to apply that handwritten highlighting onto a GIS program to convert that into an area of irrigable land?
Yes, we can do a command area map quite simply.
And so it's not an insurmountable hurdle, is it, in terms of trying to understand the maximum area of land between those two dates?
I think the dates are still quite specific. I don't know why there needs to be specific dates, why there couldn't just be a command area of this is the area that we have irrigated up to the point of lodgement.
Let's stay with the first thread, which is it possible to articulate the area irrigated between those dates?
Possibly.
Possibly.
I without being a farmer and talk to enough of them exactly about that, those dates, I couldn't tell you how easy or not.
Well, how long have you been planning for?
Planning for 15 years, but in Otago for 2.5.
And during those 2.5 years, you've had discussions with the rural community?
Yes.
Is it fair to say that farmers have a pretty good idea about what's happening on their farms?
Yes, but I don't know exactly how well their records are kept for exact years.
Right, so that's the first reason why you say that this criterion should be deleted, because you say it's simply not possible for farmers to explain or to articulate the area of land.
She didn't say that. She said she didn't know. I mean, I'd be surprised. It might just go to why we've got problems in Otago if farmers can't articulate what they're doing on their land. But that's your evidence. It's not necessarily farmers' evidence. So we'll leave it there.
Well, I think they can articulate. I just don't know exactly how well they can articulate to specific dates.
You need to be careful with this, because the impression being that you risk the impression that farmers have little or no management over their farming activities.
Yeah, I'm not trying to say that at all.
Right. Let's move on now. You gave a range of or a number of reasons as to why this criterion should be crossed out. So let's move on to the second one.
So the second one there is to allow for those properties or farmers or companies that have already invested in some relatively minor expansions of irrigation areas within their historical use. Particularly, I'm referring to here sort of horticultural businesses. Really, and potentially this then needs to come into the RDA process so it could be evaluated rather than in the controlled activity pathway, to be fair. So that where there is some minor increases as a result of already sunk investment, that could be accounted for.
Right, so that you'd be recommending a change to the policy framework and the rule framework to pick up that type of a change?
There would be a change required, yes.
And when you think about those that expand during the life of a permit, so let's pick up, say, a horticulture example, where there's been some investment. That investment would have been made through the lens of understanding the terms of the current permit?
Yes.
And is there any expectation as to whether you can renew a permit on the same terms in the future?
Yes, there is indication within the plan that you're not going to be granted, within the current regional plan, that you'll be granted, or that it'll be looked at what you've actually used from a water use perspective, not so much an irrigation area perspective.
The plans change, don't they?
They do.
And in terms of water permits, there can be no expectation that a permit will be granted again when a fresh application is lodged.
No.
And so investment decisions ought to be made taking into account that risk.
Yes.
And again, thinking about this from the perspective of risk, this is a question of who should bear that risk.
Yes.
Should the environment bear the risk, or should the abstractor bear the risk?
Probably the abstractor that should bear more of the risk, but I also come back to the duration with which these permits would sit, and this would still be the 6-year timeframe.
But we're talking about the next round of permits, aren't we? So investment that's been made historically will have been made based on the existing terms of the existing permits.
Yes.
Right, is there a third reason as to why you say this restriction should be deleted?
I don't think so.
Do you accept that increasing the irrigable area of land has the potential to increase adverse effects on the environment associated with additional nutrient loss?
There is that potential, yes, depending on the land use and depending on the historic water use method.
And Plan Change 7 does not contain any provisions to manage those types of effects?
No, it does not.
And the current regional planning framework, does that contain any provisions which manage those effects?
No, it does not.
And so if ongoing increases in irrigable area continue to occur without any restrictions in place, the environment bears the risk of those effects, doesn't it?
Yes, although I do also make reference to the National Environmental Standards for Freshwater, which put a limit only relating to increases of irrigation area for dairy land uses of 10 hectares.
Yes.
And so that, in my view, has then accepted that there isn't as significant a risk for other land uses with increases. And in Otago, the majority of those increases have been generally as a result of conversions from flood irrigation to spray, which would generally reduce the amount of runoff and nutrients you're then resulting in receiving water bodies receiving.
And were you here when, or have you heard, I think it was Dr. Olson's evidence in relation to the potential adverse effects associated with the conversion from border diking to spray irrigation?
No, his was one that I have not yet managed to listen to.
And right, I recall his evidence was that whilst there might be a reduction in the types of contaminants associated with runoff, the likes of E. coli, sediment, phosphorus, etc., that there is potentially an increase in nitrogen leaching as a result of the conversion to spray.
I'm not a water quality scientist, so I couldn't make any comment on that.
And I want to move down to the next change which occurs in your policy. So the change is recommended to 10A 2.1D, and this is, as I understand it, these are changes that have come through following the joint planning conferencing.
Yes.
And I want to move on now to what I'll just refer to as your discretionary activity policy.
Yes.
And I have some questions in relation to that policy. The first of which relates to the duration expressed in the policy. And here in the written version, in the, I'll describe it as the third paragraph, where it notes for a duration of no more than 20 years. Now, this morning you said that you've been thinking about this overnight and you now recommend that the 20 years should be moved or reduced to 15 years?
Yes.
So I should cross out the 20 and write 15 in there for the purposes of understanding your current opinion?
Yes.
And now I want to work through each of the matters referred to in this policy. So starting with the first one, where the application relates to a water body that contains threatened species likely to be affected by the activity, the application proposes measures to enhance or protect the habitat of the species. So the first part of that I want to ask you about is the reference to containing threatened species likely to be affected by the activity.
Yes.
Now, just so I'm clear, when you refer to the activity, which activity are you referring to?
The water taken use.
So this is the proposed activity, the activity yes. for which consent is proposed. And then threatened species likely to be affected by the activity. How's that worked out?
That is an assessment required depending on what species are in the water body, where they are located, whether there are other barriers in place, fish screens, the fish passage component. There's a number of factors that would be required and require scientific input.
So this is a question of science in your
yes.
mind? And then you go on to say that the application proposes measures to enhance or protect the habitat of the species. So when we look at that drafting, an applicant has a choice as to whether to enhance or protect. It's an either-either.
Yes.
And when you think about measures to enhance, when you've used the word enhance, that might amount to any small amount of improvement would be considered enhancement, wouldn't
That's correct,
it?
That's correct, yes.
And so what this first part of the policy is requiring of an applicant is that they might do just a little bit of enhancement in relation to threatened species.
Yes, recognising that the intention of this is to stop the decline that may occur within the next 6 years if we do nothing. So it is effectively to draw a line and make improvements beyond that, if possible, not to allow things to degrade further as could happen without something like this approach.
When you use the word enhance in this context, what's the environment against which you're assessing a degree of enhancement?
The current state.
Does the current state include consents which have expired in your mind?
No, we don't have consents that are expired at the moment, generally speaking.
How do you conceptualise the environment for the purposes of this policy with reference to the expiring permit? Are the effects of the expiring permit considered to be part of the environment against which you are assessing some enhancement?
I think the complexity of some of the catchments we're dealing with is that that is the case, yes, because in effect what has happened from my knowledge of some of the science in some of the catchments is that these abstractions have then potentially in some cases an abstraction is below a population of threatened galaxids and has lowered the water flows in that lower reach and therefore prevented competitive species like trout from reaching those habitats. So it, in some respects, yes, the exercise of those permits that may be expiring has led to the benefit to those populations.
When you think about the concept of the existing environment, does that include the exercise of permits that are the subject of an application to replace them?
Technically, it shouldn't, know from an assessment point of view.
So when you think about that, and then you think about what might be required in terms of enhancement, does that change the position or the level of enhancement that you have in mind here?
I think really when I'm thinking of enhancement, it's thinking of improvements to those populations of threatened species, whether that be by enhancing the level of protection that they can receive through the flow patterns or fish barriers, or whether that be by increasing flows that are in that water body to protect them and enhance their habitat.
Perhaps I'll put my question this way. Improvement compared to what?
There's improvement compared to the number and spread of their population that is occurring now.
Which is an environment inclusive of the permits that are expiring.
Yes, and I think the challenge here is trying to be able to remove the effect of those permits and understand then what that population might be without them occurring, and I don't know that there's an easy answer for that.
in fact, do you accept it would be particularly complex and difficult to undertake that assessment?
Yes.
I want to move on to number two, Roman two now. So this is picking up a situation where a water body or freshwater ecosystem is likely to be degraded or degrading as a result of the activity authorised by the permit that is expiring. Now, when you have used degraded or degrading in this context, are you referring to the state of the environment as it is with the existing permits in place?
I think in a way you have to, because as I mentioned before, it's very difficult to remove them completely, but understand that from a technical point of view, you can't consider the environment as if that was part of it. So you have to look at both, I think, in this situation.
And where you've used degraded or degrading, what do you mean by those terms?
They do have a definition included in here as they come through from the MPS. Effectively, so it's either below the national bottom lines and understand that we don't have objectives set for these catchments, so you would have to refer to the national bottom lines and the current level of water quality or habitat that is present and make an evaluative call from a scientist as to where that may sit, and then for degrading, look at whether there is any trend of decline for any of those matters and attributes.
So when I read your recommended definition, it doesn't tell me to do those things, does it?
No, not explicitly, no.
So do you understand degraded in the MPS means you're below a national bottom line? Is that your evidence?
Or a level that's been set by a regional council, which we obviously don't have at the moment.
Right, okay.
So that's quite a different thing to the definition that you've recorded or recommended in this version of the plan change.
Yes, I think there that we obviously don't have a target attribute state set for these water bodies yet.
And so when it comes to applying this policy in the absence of that information, what is a decision maker to do in light of your definition, which is pointing in a different direction?
I think that definition then potentially needs some tweaks to it for this period of transition before those target attributes are set.
And then you move on in this matter, Roman 2, that the application proposes enhancement to the waterway or in-stream ecology. So we've had a discussion about what enhancement means. Are you using that in the same way as we've discussed in terms of the first matter?
Yes, I would be.
Now, you've introduced here the concept of enhancement to the waterway or in-stream ecology. What do you mean by enhancement to the waterway in this context?
That could be flows or other values for that waterway, but except that we're primarily focusing this around threatened species. Or it could be an enhancement to water quality. It's not limited in this.
Well, this matter doesn't say anything about water quality or threatened species, does it?
No.
Except that the way that you've worded this in terms of referring to waterway is particularly broad.
Yes, except that.
And so again, when it comes to a decision maker trying to apply this policy, it would be particularly difficult for them to understand what it was that was meant by this policy, or this part of the policy.
Yes, I accept there probably needs to be further consideration of the way it's drafted and what it's referring to, but effectively you'd be looking at those attributes in the MPS as part of your degraded or degrading assessment, and so it would be whether there's any enhancement to those attributes for the waterway.
Do you see that, let's say, in 5 years' time, somebody's trying to interpret this policy, connecting between what's written here and that which you've just said, the dots really don't connect, do they?
Not clearly at the moment, though. But one matter I did note when considering this overnight is that I'd need to be more clear on what permits and what catchments are in play that will be expiring between October of this year and 2025. But from my broad understanding is that the majority of those catchment-based or sub-catchment-based groups that could apply under this rule are primarily in the deemed permit camp and have actually already been lodged. We're probably not looking at a large number that would be able to fit under this rule in the next 4 years. It's probably mostly just those that have already applied at that catchment group level.
So that's an assumption that you've been relying on rather than knowledge of the factual situation?
Correct. I don't know exactly, but that would be my assumption from my current level of knowledge.
Staying with Roman 2, the alternative to enhancement of the waterway is enhancement to the in-stream ecology. So what do you mean there? What do you mean in terms of enhancement to in-stream ecology?
It would be on the lines of improvement to the habitat breadth or numbers of species present. I would need a scientist's input here to actually to make those sort of assessments.
And again, the policy doesn't really explain precisely what you have in mind in terms of that enhancement.
No, it probably doesn't.
Probably doesn't or doesn't?
No, it doesn't.
No, okay, because what council's getting at, Small's getting at, is that there's no outcome stated.
No, and I accept that there is significant improvements to the drafting that would be required.
And your evidence isn't informed, aside from Ms Bright, beyond that, you've got no evidence of a technical nature informing the words that you put up here.
No.
And what they mean and where they may go, even if you were to express an outcome, an outcome.
No, I accept that, and it has been somewhat informed by the experts of other parties present. And I think the only way this could probably be drafted in a really robust fashion is with a group of planners represented by different parties.
You see, I beg to differ. I think you need technical input to this.
Yeah, fair point.
Mm. All right, carry on.
To move on to Roman 3. So where measures to achieve protection or enhancement. Now, we haven't talked about protection, have we, in relation to Romans 1 and 2. Do you see that protection sets the bar higher than a little bit of enhancement?
It can be or it cannot be. It could be protecting the current level or it could be protecting an ideal level.
So when you say protecting the current level, what do you mean?
Protecting the habitat or species that are present now.
With or without the exercise of permits expiring?
I think both matters have to come into consideration.
But again, your drafting doesn't make that clear, does it?
No.
So staying with Roman 3, where these measures you say are necessary, you're adding another layer of decision-making required in terms of decision-maker having to determine that it's necessary for enhancement or protection. What do you mean by having used the word necessary in this context?
No, I think that's potentially a drafting issue, and it's more saying where one or two, where you've sort of met the thresholds of one or two, and the only way to enter this rule is where one or two apply. So it's more that where one or two apply, not that they are necessary.
Well, when you say that they are necessary to enter the rule, let me just have a look at the rule. So I'm looking at rule 10A 3.2. Where does it say that those are entry conditions into the rule?
No, so it doesn't, and that's something that needs a bit of further consideration. They should be actually entry conditions. But recognising that it's complex to write something like that as an entry condition.
So in your mind, the entry conditions into the discretionary activity rule require that the application is in an area where contains threatened species likely to be affected by the proposed activity?
Yes.
And, or is it or, that the freshwater ecosystems are likely to be degraded, putting aside the complexities we've discussed about that? Is it both of those things, one or other of those things?
I think actually it could be one or other. Probably one or other. It could be an or there.
It could be, but...
It should be an or there.
You envisage an environment that has species likely to be affected by an activity that isn't also degraded?
I would need a scientist's input to confirm that.
All right, let's get back to Roman 3. So we've talked about necessary, and I'm still a little uncertain about what you mean there, other than you say there should be an entry condition on the discretionary activity rule. That's what you mean by necessary?
Well, it's more meaning that if one and two are triggered, then three follows on from that.
Right, staying with three, these should include consideration of fish passage. I want to focus on the phrase include consideration. So consideration doesn't require any action.
No.
So an applicant just needs to say, I've considered all of these things, but I'm not going to do them.
I think that those words potentially could be changed to something like should assess, so that they have to actually assess the effects, not to say, I thought about them, I'm not thinking about them any further. And that's not the intent, that it's just a passing thought. It's that there actually needs to be an assessment.
Right, so you assess them and then say, well, here's my assessment. Then what?
Well, it depends on what the assessment concludes as to whether fish passage is required or needs to be protected, for example, and that's where you need the science input on what's actually going on in that water body.
So where does this policy say that?
Reading it as it's written, it doesn't specifically. It's more identifying matters that you do need to assess and consider as part of the application process. And the outcomes from that are informed by the scientists, and then the discretion that is there from the consent authority to make a decision as to what may be then required as flows or limits or consent conditions.
There's a lot of assumption required to get to an outcome that's not clearly expressed.
I accept that, and it's somewhat similar to the position we currently have been taking under the RPW, is to assess all those matters, and they're not necessarily explicitly laid out any more than we're sort of seeing here.
Which perhaps highlights the current predicament the council's in terms of its existing water plan.
Yes.
Right, Roman 4, the application enables and is part of an integrated management approach, including as a minimum. So when you say the application enables, what do you have in mind when you've used those words?
That they're basically part of a group that are looking at an integrated management approach, and by putting those parties together, you're enabling that to occur. If you didn't bring parties together, you could all well and good to have an approach set, but if the parties aren't on board with it and all in there together, you can't enable that approach.
So when you think about that, do you require then multiple consent applications, or is this one joint consent application? What do you have in mind when you have used these words in this policy?
It could be either, but you'd be looking at whether they were individual applications coming in together as a group that have then considered similar science or management approaches that are similar across both applications. And that is similar to the way the likes of the Manahere Care has been approached to date in its applications.
what happens for an individual consent holder, say on a tributary? This pathway is not available?
I wouldn't think so, no.
And insofar as there might be these risks you've highlighted and on a tributary, then your recommendation in terms of the discretionary activity doesn't deal with that situation?
No, this won't capture everyone or every population of threatened species.
How many people within a catchment will be required to fit within this policy in your mind? Is it all consent holders in a catchment? Is it some of them? Is it two of them?
I think the preference would be the majority.
And where does it say that in your policy?
It doesn't specifically say that in there or the definitions, no.
When you think about taking a coordinated catchment-wide approach, would a simple majority actually achieve the environmental outcomes that might be sought? And let's start by examining that in the context of a minimum flow.
It will be challenging if there is a number of consents with large quantities of water being taken that are not part of that group, then you're not likely to achieve that, no. But it is dependent on how many permits, the water body, the flows, the levels. It's very case specific, I think.
So isn't it more appropriate to step back and assess at a catchment-wide level what the appropriate flows and minimum flows and allocation blocks are through the new water and land plan, rather than doing it through consent by consent?
Yes, I accept that, but the risk is if you don't do anything on some of these catchments, you're going to end up in a far worse state in 6 years' time, from my understanding of some of the science evidence that we've heard, than we would be waiting 6 years through a rollover and then undertaking that work then.
Now, you've broken your Roman 4 into three sub-paragraphs as well.
Yes.
And there you refer to surface water, including through flow sharing, membership in a water management group, and imposition of flow limits.
Yes.
Is there any policy guidance as to what those terms mean in the context of Plan Change 7?
Not in PC 7, no.
And so a decision maker seeking to implement this policy may be left in a position of uncertainty about what those terms mean.
The way it's drafted now, yes. There may need to be some reference back to those aspects in the current plan?
Well, when you think about how Plan Change 7 is drafted, do you understand that it operates as a code, or do you understand it acts together with the existing water plan?
It's mostly sitting on its own, apart from the reference for policies to new water permits.
So that's the only one which would apply, and so further changes would need to be made to the text of Plan Change 7 to bring in other policy considerations?
Yes, they would.
And that would be a significant change?
Yes.
And a change not signalled in the land pro submission?
Not explicitly, no.
And to move on to subparagraph B, consideration of the impact of land use. So we've had a discussion about consideration and what that means. So would your evidence in relation to the use of consideration under Roman 3 equally apply here?
Yes, I think that could easily be, or should be, changed to the word assessment.
But again, assessment doesn't require action, does it?
No.
Assessment's in fact no more than consideration.
No, you could interpret that word both the same way.
So is it your evidence that that is all that is required?
I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it's saying you need to assess the impacts, and if your assessment concluded that there was significant impacts, I don't think any decision maker would then be able to grant a consent under Section 104 for a discretionary pathway. Well, they may be able to, they may decide to, but that would be a significant consideration if there was to be significant adverse effects on water quality as a result of this.
Is that what you're after, significant adverse effects on water quality?
No, I haven't used the word significant.
No. So what's your outcome?
So I was saying that if an assessment concluded that there was adverse effects that needed to be addressed, that could be dealt with through the consent process and through the decision maker's recommendation.
Mm. Continue, Mr. Wilmore.
When you then are assessing against that outcome, now that outcome is not captured in the policy as currently drafted, is it?
No.
So hold that thought. If that's what you're seeking to achieve, what mechanism does Plan Change 7 have in it to properly assess the effects of land use on water quality? How would you do that?
Would be purely a scientific assessment rather than reference back to a specific policy.
And what does it do? So in practice, have you been involved in any applications that assess the effect of irrigation on and land use activities on water quality?
Not substantial amount recently, no.
So when
not
you've recommended these changes, what technical input have you relied upon, given you haven't had the experience?
That is technical input from other colleagues at LandPro who have. But so it's not referred to in any evidence, I accept that.
And those... No, you've answered that. I want to move on to subparagraph C.
Mm-hmm.
And here you say that the minimum flow limit set in Schedule 2A should be imposed on the replacement consent.
Yes.
When you say any minimum flow set out in Schedule 2A, which minimum flow are you referring to?
Well, there is a minimum flow that's separate to an allocation limit in Schedule 2A for specific water bodies.
Right. So it doesn't say that, does it?
No, you could change any to the minimum flow.
And do you understand how those minimum flows in Schedule 2A were set?
I am not specifically up to speed on exactly how they were set, no.
Have you assessed the appropriateness of those minimum flows for a 15-year period?
I haven't taken that step, no.
And so you've just recommended this change because you feel that's a sensible thing to do?
Well, they exist in the plan at present. There was obviously some basis for setting them, so that is better than not having something in place in terms of any minimum flow on some of these catchments.
The effect of bringing through these minimum flows would lock in place a pre-NPS FM 2020 flow and allocation regime?
For the term of that consent that's granted, yes.
So we're talking about this 15-year term that you're now recommending?
If it wasn't reviewed to change that minimum flow during that term.
And we've covered the complexities associated with reviews. Right, on to Roman 5. I've read the regional policy statement and I can't see any reference to timeframes to meet Te Mana or Te Wai objectives relevant to the activity.
No, that is in reference to the upcoming RPS, which I understand will include timeframes for that. It's more the intention that we know that there are timeframes coming, and I accept that if a decision was to be made on this tomorrow, that wouldn't work because that's not in that. Is it more of what's in the proposed RPS as opposed to the current RPS?
So your drafting's a long way away from reflecting what you've just said as the intention of this part of the policy.
Yes, it is. I accept that. It would need work.
As a planner, is it appropriate to refer to a draft regional policy statement that's not before the decision maker and that parties haven't seen?
No, generally you wouldn't take that approach, no. It's just really trying to come up with something relatively quickly that captured the intent of the direction that I thought an interim kind of 15-year longer term pathway should achieve.
How do you assess the efficiency and effectiveness of incorporating a document that's unknown?
I don't think you can.
Right, we move on now to Roman 6. The allocation proposed is the lesser of the rate using the methodology in 10A5 or efficient volume as set out in Schedule 10 A5.
Yes, I accept there's an error with B and that I haven't actually included that schedule in here.
Right, so when you... So what schedule are you referring to? Are you still recommending that an assessment occur in relation to efficient volume?
Yes, I think for a longer term, efficient volume should definitely come into play. I know this is particularly the case where, in this situation, in order to achieve the protection or enhancement required, a lot of water users will be required to upgrade their systems that might currently be flood. And trying to just, if you just included a historical rate limit and allocation from what's now Schedule 10A5 in my documents, but actually if we refer it to as Schedule 10A4 for how we've generally been referring to it, that wouldn't necessarily be an appropriate number for a longer term permit.
So where do I look at to consider the appropriateness of your wording for a Schedule 10A5 for the reasonable use?
There isn't that volume there, but effectively that's referring to the Aqualink guidelines. So that could be changed to an efficient volume as assessed using the Aqualink guidelines rather than Schedule 10A5 and B.
And have you assessed the appropriateness of using those guidelines to inform reasonable use?
I've used those to inform reasonable use for applications, yes.
Have you assessed the appropriateness of using those guidelines for this reasonable use assessment? What technical input have you had as to the appropriateness of the use of the Aqualink guidelines?
I have not had specific technical input into this, but I have had discussions with Ms. Bright, who has mentioned the appropriateness of Aqualink and mentioned that in the primary sector joint witness statement. It was an outcome from that joint witness statement that Aqualink has a place in Plan Change 7, and this, I think, would be the place for it as well.
My reading of the joint witness statements from the technical witnesses was that the reference to Aqualink guidelines might be used to inform historical use when water metering data didn't accurately reflect water metering data. Have I misread the joint witness statement?
No, that was part of that as well.
So where do you say that the joint witness statement says Aqualink can be used to do a reasonable use assessment in the context of a discretionary activity rule?
It may not be specifically mentioned in that, and I could be getting confused with the conversations I've had with my technical expert, Ms. Bright, with regards to the use of Aqualink for efficiency assessments for all applications.
Right, on to the matter number Roman 7. To exercise the replacement water permit on the terms proposed in the application would require substantial investment in new infrastructure. What is substantial investment?
I accept substantial is not defined. It's going to be an applicant-specific. Substantial to one farmer will be not substantial to another, so I accept that there is not clarity in that at the moment. But the intention behind that is that there will be upgrades, for example, as I mentioned before, from a flood irrigation system to a spray irrigation system, which is a substantial investment, and the level of investment will change depending on what type of spray system, for example, the farmer was to use.
So is your evidence that this only applies, we're changing irrigation systems to improve efficiency, or something else?
No, it's not just that. That's one level of investment in infrastructure that may be required. Another one may be the way the water is conveyed around the property or the intake point. So for an open race system could be upgraded to a pipe system, for example, which would increase its efficiency and potentially reduce the amount of water that may be required. I think there's a whole lot of different infrastructure upgrades that could occur.
I'll return to you, Mr. Moore. I'm interested in what does substantial mean.
So when you think about your discretionary activity rule, there's no restriction on the irrigable area?
No, there's not in there.
And so simply increasing the irrigable area by extending out an irrigation system might be substantial investment?
Yes, I accept that potentially there should be a limit, much like there would be in terms of what you've historically irrigated, accounting for any existing investment that's already been accounted for.
quite sure whether that was what Ms Moore was asking. Actually. Do you want to put your question again?
Yeah, I'll try again. So we'll do it in bite sizes. Your discretionary activity has no restriction on the irrigable area?
No, it doesn't at present.
And so if the irrigable area is to be increased and infrastructure is required to facilitate that increase in area?
What I was then saying was that I think now, looking at it, potentially there should be a limit like there is on the other...
Let's not get to what needs to happen. I'm just trying to understand the effect of the drafting that you have put forward to understand whether it means what you think it means or means something else. So looking at this drafting, so we're increasing the irrigable area. Mm-hmm. An applicant could say, that's required substantial investment because I've had to increase my irrigation infrastructure to increase my area. That would tick the box.
The way that's drafted, yes, that would. But that's not the intention.
Right, so tell me what your intention was in relation to this matter.
The intention behind this is that the changes that may be required to achieve the enhancement or protection outcomes talked about earlier, that may result in significant changes in the reliability of supply or the quantity of water with which an applicant might be able to take. Therefore, they may need to make substantial changes on farm or to their intake infrastructure to actually action those changes or to buffer the changes in reliability, such as storage dams, changes to spray.
There'd be nothing stopping an applicant saying, well, I need to increase my efficiency on this part of my farm, and the only way to do that is if I increase my productivity by expanding my irrigable area, and that's my substantial investment.
I accept the way this is worded, that could cover that, yes.
So your wording's a long, long way away from what your intention is here. It doesn't really pick up what you're describing to me as your thinking behind this.
No, and I accept that this is drafted in a short period of time, and having questions like this actually makes you think a bit more about some aspects of it and the way someone else could read it. So I accept that there's a lot of benefit in that.
You need to be very careful when you're recommending these sorts of provisions as part of a planning framework. Requires really careful thought, doesn't it?
I accept that, yes.
And so to wrap up the discussion on substantial investment, you'd accept that, as drafted, this provision is ambiguous?
Yes.
And it doesn't clearly articulate the outcome that you had in mind when you drafted it?
No, it doesn't.
Right, I want to move on to the controlled activity now. You've deleted the restriction on the irrigation area?
Yes.
And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's for the same reasons we discussed when we discussed the policy.
Yes, they're linked together.
You've recommended a change to Roman 4, so a matter of control 4.
Yes.
And this relates to the rate of take?
Yes, it's consistent. This is from the planner's joint witness statement, attachment 1.
Now, not all planners agree with this change.
No, that's correct.
And the council's planner, Mr. De Pelsmaker, doesn't agree with this change.
That's correct.
And he's expressed a view that allowing for any data or any water years after effectively the notification date of Plan Change 7 gives rise to a risk that consent holders could ramp up their takes for a small period of time in order to justify a higher grant on renewal?
Yes, and I think we discussed this yesterday in similar questions, that I think the risk is relatively low that that will happen, but it is a risk that it could happen.
And so when you think about a plan through the lens of Te Mana or Te Wai, who should bear that risk, the environment or the abstractor?
I think the abstractor should bear that risk, but I don't think there is a significant risk for 6 years.
Well, if there's not a significant risk, let's not take the risk and leave the date of June 2020 in there. Isn't that the right thing to do, vis-a-vis Te Mana or Te Wai?
You could do that, and it would mean that effectively I would imagine that most applicants after this point in time would not be able to take the control pathway. Because basically anyone that's up to 2025 would want to use their most recent data to explain what their historical use has been.
But you've just said to the court that there's not a substantial risk of rates of take ramping up, but you're now saying all applicants who don't have a permit expiring through to 2025 would want to use their most recent data. That presumably would only be because that data gives them a higher allocation of water under the schedule. So there is a substantial risk.
Not necessarily. It's potentially, I mean, the schedule, as we've talked about, there is a risk that if you, well, there's some applicants that might only have 2 or 3 years of data prior to this point, and their use of data beyond 2020 may give them a clearer picture as to what their use has actually been. And I don't think there is any real risk of including that versus not. I think it would be preferential, based on the expert evidence from Ms. Bright, to include that data.
Well, Ms. Bright's evidence was that there was a risk associated with an increase over that period.
And I have said that, yes, there is a risk as well.
And you've said that the environment should not bear that risk.
No.
So why is it that you maintain your position that the date range should be extended out?
I think there is clear examples that I have where that would mean that people can't take the controlled activity pathway when there hasn't been a ramp up of use for any adverse reason. But I accept that if this is a point that we can't get agreement on between parties, potentially that then can fall into the RDA pathway, but I'm making assumptions that all users would take that pathway, but there is a potential that there might be users that have justified reasons for it reflecting historic use beyond June 2020 that then are unable to use that in the controlled activity pathway.
Struggling to understand what your evidence is on this point. You accept that there is a risk that allowing water use or water years beyond June 2020 may result in increases of water take?
Yes, there is a small risk, yes.
And you'd say that that's a small risk?
I couldn't quantify it, but I don't think it would be a large risk, but without looking, I think as I said yesterday, without looking at the data and the consent limits for all the permits between now and 2025, I don't think you could quantify it explicitly.
And then you say that when it comes to allocating that risk, the risk should be borne by abstractors and not the environment.
I don't think the environment should bear that risk, no.
So then the logical conclusion, isn't it, that the controlled activity date is June 2020.
It could fall from that, but I would need to see the level of risk in more detail to say for certain that that should be the case that has to follow from that.
But you've just told me that the environment shouldn't bear the risk.
But if there is not really any risk, then why shouldn't an applicant be able to use that data?
We'll move on. The same applies to Roman 6. Roman 6 relates to the volumes as opposed to the instantaneous rates.
Yes.
And presumably the same discussion we've just had on the instantaneous rate would apply in terms of your recommendations for change to Roman 6.
Yes.
And again, when it comes to volumes of water, the environment shouldn't take the risk of increases?
No.
Right, when we look at the matters of control, I think yesterday we did talk about matter A.
Yes, we did.
And we need not traverse that territory again. Well, I have no questions for you in relation to the restricted discretionary activity rule. And we've talked briefly about your recommended discretionary activity.
Yes.
And you mentioned that there would need to be drafting changes made to your discretionary activity to properly reflect the entry conditions that you had in mind that are currently included in the policy. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, I think the way reading that discretionary rule, it doesn't effectively limit who should be taking that path, and I think there does need to be some way of reflecting that not anyone could just take that path in terms of a rule entry.
And so the wording that you've put forward is flawed in that regard?
Yes.
I want to move on to the non-complying activity. Now, we did have some discussion about what your evidence now is in relation to the non-complying activity. Now, when I read these provisions last night, as they are drafted in this document, I was left with the impression that there might be a gap in the planning framework that you've recommended in relation to activities or applications which don't meet the conditions of either the controlled activity where the RDA doesn't apply, or the RDA, or potentially even your discretionary activity consent. So when we think about these rules operating as a drop-down, I don't understand what the activity status should be for activities that don't meet some of those conditions. So can you help me understand what your thinking is if particular conditions are not able to be or not complied with? What is the drop-down? And I should say the drop-down in circumstances where if you could just help me understand your thinking.
Yeah, so actually I've just noticed that it's repeated twice, that non-complying activity rule in this version.
I did wonder about that.
So just strike out the first version of it, because the second version actually has the numbering convention corrections.
Okay. So
that was a copy and paste error last night.
So delete, for the record, delete the first version of 10A 3.3, a non-complying activity rule.
Yes. And so you're asking, Mr. Moore, then if something didn't comply with the controlled activity condition and it didn't then fit within an RDA condition, then effectively, unless it could meet the thresholds for entry that I think would be required for the discretionary, it would be non-compliant.
What if it was a permit expiring on 1 October 2035?
Oh, so this rule should be changed to, as I think I mentioned earlier, only a 6-year term. I don't think there should be the ability for an application to be lodged for greater than the 15-year term allowed for by the discretionary rule as part of this transition.
So what would you recommend be changed to achieve that?
You'd need to take out the words "where the term sought would result in the permit expiring after 1 October 2041, just strike that out. And make a change to B. I can't come up with the exact words, but effectively saying unless it's provided for under Rule 10A 3.2.1. That the term should be for 6 years.
Just pause a sec. Would that make sense? So in this provider for under the controlled activity rule, the term is 6 years.
Yes.
The controlled activity rule, the term is 6 years.
Yes, so the controlled activity rule is already covered by the rule, and that's 6 years.
Yeah.
The RDA is 6 years.
Yeah.
The discretionary is 15.
Mm.
And so this rule would then basically say that that has to be the term.
What has to be the term?
The 6 years has to be the term. I can't on the hoof come up with the wording for you.
So is that conceptually an entry condition into the non-complying rule?
No, so I'm just looking at it actually now. No, that needs to be the policy, and this rule just really needs to be that unless that anything that's not provided for under the other three rules is a non-complying. And then the policy then needs to be there that says that that should be for 6 years. I was just confusing myself between the rule and the policy there.
So I've just noted it should say anything not provided for under
the other three rules.
Under the other three rules is not complying. But then you would also need to amend the policies to make clear the terms for each of those policies, and controlled in RDA being 6 years and discretionary being 15.
Yes, and I think I mentioned that earlier, that that is something that's missing at the moment in terms of those policies. It didn't get pulled through a policy still relating to the duration with the change to the discretionary rule or discretionary policy.
You accept that you'd need to be very careful with the wording of how the non-complying activity rule is drafted to ensure that there wasn't a gap in the framework?
Yes, I accept that. I don't think it would be any really different from what was drafted in the 14th of March version, where it previously said that does not meet any one or more of the conditions of those two rules listed there, and you would simply be adding a third rule in there with the note that you'd have to amend the discretionary activity rule, as we've just discussed.
The reason we need to be careful about this is because an activity that might otherwise fall through a gap would be an innominate activity and processed as a discretionary activity.
Yes.
Turned over to the definitions now. Now we've explored the definition of degraded or degrading, so we don't need to traverse the challenges there. Now, I see that there's a definition of community water supply.
Yes.
Now, my understanding is that that's come about through the conferencing in relation to how community supplies are to be treated.
Yes, that's correct.
Did you participate in that conferencing?
I wasn't part of the community supply conferencing, but the planners conferencing where we came up with the definition of that, yes, I was part of that.
I have some questions about the definition, and I wonder whether I might be a better place to put those questions to the planning witness for the territorial authorities?
Probably best place. He did start the drafting and we spent a bit of time on it, and it is tricky. But we also acknowledge that this was for the short term, that was for PC7's definition only. It's not a wider definition that would necessarily be carried through into the Land and Water Plan.
Well, I'll pick that up with Mr. Tews later today. Now, the final set of changes are changes recommended to be made to the schedule. My understanding is you've just pulled through the changes recommended from the planning conferencing.
Yes, and you'll note that I, instead of keeping the other changes in my previous version attached to my supplementary evidence, which was slightly different from those that came out of conferencing, I then just put the yellow highlight saying that there would be further changes required to those schedules for the record there.
I understand. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. We can take the morning adjournment, I think, because we're going to be hearing from you, Ms. Baker-Galloway, next. Okay, thank you.
Please all stand.